The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
For Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody. We are back here in Washington, D.C., where the government is slowly reopening today, and we've gone from the extraordinary dysfunction to the everyday dysfunction of D.C., return to normalcy. We're going to spend much of the show talking about what's happened in the government shutdown and what the ramifications are for the deal that was cut last night and signed into law by the president. Joining us for much of the show, two of my esteemed colleagues from the Patton Boggs Washington, D.C. office. We have Stephen Gavin on the political right and Clark Irvin on the political left, and they're going to help us analyze all of the things that have happened. So let's start, as I said, Clark, with you. The government is reopening. Tell us a little bit about what you think happens now.
Right. Well, you know, this is a temporary solution to the problem, Kevin. This deal funds the government at current levels only through mid-January, January 15 to be precise, and it lifts the budget, the debt ceiling, only through early February, February 7. In the meantime, the House Budget Committee, which is led by Paul Ryan, Republican of Wisconsin, and the Senate Budget Committee, led by Democrat Patty Murray of Washington State, are supposed to meet in a conference and reconcile their competing versions of the budget, and in addition to that, by December 13, ideally, come up with a comprehensive plan to fix this so that it doesn't happen again, just in a couple of months or so. Ideally, they would come up with a plan to tackle entitlement reform, which consumes the bulk of the budget and will continue to do so as time goes by over the years. Also, ideally, tackle tax reform and fix the sequester, these draconian cuts in each agency such that the agency heads don't have the discretion to cut fat rather than the bone. But, of course, if history is any guide, and it is, then they're highly unlikely, I would say, to reach a deal. We all know that the super committee some years back was a conspicuous failure. The president and the Democrats have been willing to give on entitlement reform, which is a Republican priority, but they've demanded in exchange that there be some progress on tax reform and that there be some tax revenue, and that's been a non-starter for the Republicans, and I would argue will certainly be a non-starter for next year, which is, of course, an election year. So I'd say that the likelihood is no big budget deal, and we're in the same mess again. And, of course, you know, there's deep, deep partisan acrimony now, more than before the shutdown. And, of course, the holidays are approaching, and as I said before, we're looking at 2014. The one potential cause for a little bit of optimism is precisely because this has been such a bruising fight over the last 16 days. That might mean that there might be more willingness to compromise on a bipartisan basis this time around than last, but as we say in my native Texas, I sure wouldn't bet the ranch on it.
Well, Stephen, let me turn to you. Let's do a little analysis of the votes last night. In the Senate, yep. 81-18, every senator who's a prospective 2016 candidate for president on the right voted against the deal last yep. night. You yep. move over to the House, the votes 285-144. You basically had, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of high 80s in the terms of numbers of Republicans.
Yeah, I think 85.
Voted for that deal. You had Speaker Boehner and Majority Leader Cantor vote for the deal. I think McCarthy did as well, but notably Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan, former vice presidential nominee, as well as I think a number of other committee chairmen and influential members of the Republican conference voted against it. The strong majority of Republicans voted against it. So talk to me a little bit about that split, what it means for going forward.
Well, what I think that it means going forward that I agree with Clark that this is going to be very difficult to get something done by the 15th. To use the phrase, they've kicked the can down the aisle, but I'm not sure that they have kicked the can sufficiently far down the aisle to give them time to come to some kind of real agreement. I think that the sense was the need to keep a deadline close, otherwise they wouldn't, you know, that they would be even less incentive to get something done. But I think that the one thing that the Republicans, I think, have going for them is that, in at least it's my perspective, that there is less of an appetite for keeping the sequester on the part of Democrats, particularly those worried about social spending. And so that is one thing that the Republicans can take into these discussions. But, you know, you pointed out that you've got Paul Ryan heading up the House Budget Committee, and he voted against the bills last night. Although I would say that of the leaders in the House who voted against, I do think that Ryan is probably somebody who has a wider perspective as to what's going on than somebody other. And part of Ryan's whole complaint, if you read what the quotes on him today are, that precisely that it did not address the long-term issues, that it should have done at this time. Why are we pushing it out further? So perhaps there's a possibility for Ryan to be able to present a plan to more of those group outside of the 85 Republicans that voted for the measure last night. But it's going to be very, very difficult. And Clark's right. The partisanship is about as bad as I can ever remember it here. I've lived here in Washington 35 years and covered and monitored these issues closely. And it's hard to imagine a worse time.
We've got Clark and Stephen in different phone booths. We don't even want to put you guys together. The partisanship is so bad these days. Clark,
they told me I had to stay home and take this from the House, otherwise that we would be too close if we were in the same building.
There you go. Clark, I want to ask you, given your expertise and past experience in national defense, homeland security issues, walk us through some of the nuts and bolts of what the shutdown has meant for our national security apparatus, what difficulties we will have in getting things back up and running.
Well, you bet, Kevin. You know, I really worry a lot about this. As you know, I was the Inspector General at the State Department at the beginning of the Bush administration, the first Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security. So my particular focus is national security matters, and I'm hugely concerned about the national security impact that this has already had and this is likely to continue to have. You know, the Director of National Intelligence, General Clapper, said about a week ago or so that he had to furlough about 70% of the intelligence community. They're largely civilians, and a lot of those are contractors. And he said, you know, it was a perfect time for foreign intelligence agencies, the Russians, the Chinese, and for terrorists to recruit spies among us, you know, given the economic pressures that so many government employees are under. And, you know, this is a time, by the way, the backdrop against which this is playing out is we've got crises with Iran, we've got a crisis in Syria, we've got a crisis with North Korea, and, of course, there's the ever-present threat of terrorism. And conspicuously, because of the budget mess, the president had to cancel his trip to Asia at a time when the new president of China was not only there, but was passing out billions of dollars like it was candy at a time when foreign aid is a dirty word here in Washington. So, you know, as the president said today, this is a self-inflicted wound, and the world is really looking at us and just bewildered by what's going on. We're becoming a country like Italy, unable to govern and function. And I took great note of this statement by the Chinese leadership the other day, saying, you know, this might be a time to consider a de-Americanized world. So this could well be an inflection point where, you know, it calls into question American leadership. As you know, Kevin, I'm going to be in Mexico next month for a meeting of the Trilateral Commission, Foreign Policy
group of business leaders, American and European and Asian. And actually next week I'll be in Germany talking to a corporate group about foreign policy matters, and I'm sure all the questions will be about what in the world is going on in America and why are we so dysfunctional.
You know, that I completely concur with the that concern, Kevin. My practice has me overseas most of the time at this point, and I can't tell you a conversation that didn't include a question about what's going on in the United States. Between the total fiasco of the Syria, the use of chemical weapons in Syria, and the president's threat, and then back off to intervene, which presented a huge, huge victory, particularly to the Russians. And this budgetary crisis, which I think Clark correctly suggests the chaos of a parliamentary system like Italy, is a major, major point in where we are as the leader of the free world. And people are wondering, I think it's not just the Chinese, but a lot of other people are wondering whether we're going to be dealing with the United States retired from the world as it did in the 1920s, but still have a tremendous impact when things go wrong economically in the United States on the rest of the world economic system.
Well, let me ask you very quickly, winners and losers in the shutdown of the last 2 weeks. And we'll start with winners, and then I'll come back to losers. Clark, tell me your winners and why.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, whatever one's politics, and I actually technically am a Republican, though I supported the president both these last two elections, I think there's no question, but the president's a big winner here. You know, the rap on the president among Democrats is that he, over time, has been too willing to negotiate, too willing to capitulate and get nothing in return for. But this time, he stood firm. He said, you know, we're not going to negotiate with hostage takers because, you know, they keep taking hostages and upping their demands. And, of course, refused to defund or to significantly delay his signature achievement, an achievement which was ratified in the 2012 election and affirmed by the Supreme Court. So really, the Republicans got nothing but a huge pummeling in the polls for it. There was a minor tweak on Obamacare, a tightening of income verification, but that was really nothing. So there's no question that he was a big winner here. I'd also say that the Democrats generally are big winners. They, too, the party took a hit in the polls, but again, nothing like Republicans. And further, you know, I'm old enough to remember when Democrats were the fractious party, when they couldn't agree on anything, and they've been remarkably united over the course of the president's presidency, but certainly over the course of this last shutdown. And then finally, this is arguable, certainly, but one could argue that Senator Cruz was a winner in this sense. It kind of depends on what his objective was. If his objective was to defund Obamacare or significantly to change it, which was, of course, his stated objective, then obviously he was a huge, huge loser. But if the objective was simply to raise his national profile, to raise money, to win the straw polls and position himself to be the front runner for the Republican nomination in 2016, he succeeded in spades.
All right. Stephen, your winners.
I would just start with, I disagree with the last one. I think Cruz was actually a loser, and I'll address that later. I would say one of the big winners was Harry Reid. Consistently stayed on message, consistently pushed back, and I think kept the Democrats in the Senate completely in line, even with people who were concerned about certain aspects of the implementation of Obamacare. Excuse me, I'm in my
apartment. All
right,
Clark, let me come back to you while Stephen is dealing with that. Apparently, Democratic forces have broken into his house and are taking him away for his disagreement with the administration. Tell me who you think the losers are in this debate. Oh, go ahead, Stephen.
But I think Reid is a big winner, and I think actually Rand Paul has to be considered a winner, too, because he distanced himself from Cruz. And within the sort of Tea Party group is the more logical person.
Go ahead and put us back on mute there, Stephen, if you can. And Clark, let me come back to you and ask about the losers in the process.
Well, there's no question but that the Republican Party generally is a huge loser here. There was a poll that the Washington Post and ABC News did a couple of days ago. It showed that the GOP had a 74% disapproval rate, so that went up 11 points since the start of the shutdown versus a 61% approval for Democrats, which held steady over the course of the shutdown. So the party as a whole was a big loser. As I said earlier, they literally got nothing for this 16-day shutdown. I would also argue that the Speaker was a huge loser. He tried a number of times to bring up bills that would get something in exchange for this and wasn't able to get the votes in his own caucus for doing so. And so seems to me, to the extent he had a strategy, the ultimate strategy in the end was simply to show that the party had no alternative but in the end to do what they did last night and to vote for the package that the Senate leadership put together. Now, he did, I think, preserve his speakership. You know, the comments from the caucus today is that even those who are the most hard right are likely to vote for him again in January when the vote is up again. So to the extent his speakership was endangered over the course of this shutdown, I think he cemented his position. But
yeah,
you know,
I think
the question is
there, Clark. My guess is that what we're hearing is we're not going to throw him out this year.
Yeah.
His speakership isn't up until January 14 if they're able to hold a majority. My guess is that they're not interested in a midterm turnover, but I really question whether or not there aren't going to be a lot of people already sitting around planning their leadership campaign, figuring that this group right here is mortally wounded and ready to be taken down under the right circumstances by other groups inside that conference. It's obviously very fractured on that front right now.
Right,
yeah, and I think
that
he was lucky to get as many votes from the Republicans as he did.
And what's he really speaker of? You know, what's he really the leader of, even if he maintains it going forward?
Yeah. Well, you know what? Let's take a quick break. We'll come back with more questions about the shutdown and its implications. You're listening to Capital Thinking.
Stay up to date on the latest news out of Washington affecting your business. Check out Patton Boggs' new Capital Thinking blog at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. Let one of the world's best legal and political intelligence networks keep you in the loop on the policy developments that matter to you most. Access the network today at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. That's capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business. Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. We're talking to Clark Irvin and Stephen Gavin from Patton Boggs about the implications of the shutdown and debt ceiling deal that was cut last night in the halls of Congress and signed into law by the President of the United States. And I want to talk now about the efforts to put together a budget resolution. We're going to have a conference committee. The House already announced its appointed conferees, as did the Senate. My own impression, Clark and Stephen, is that in Paul Ryan and Patty Murray, you have people that have a tremendous gulf between them in terms of ideological perspectives about spending in Washington, but also have deep respect inside their own parties and have the ability to reach out and cut a deal as they've done in the past. So let me start with you, Clark. Tell me a little bit about how you think the budget negotiations between now and mid-December play out.
Right. Well, I agree with you, Kevin, that there's no question but that Senator Murray and Chairman Ryan come from opposite ideological poles. But on the other hand, they really are, as you say, respected in their caucuses. And they're also, I would argue, they're pragmatists, and they have shown themselves to be willing to compromise. And so you couldn't have two better people leading this effort. That said, you know, the structural, for want of a better word, constraints that we've talked about earlier in the segment remain. And so I think it's going to be very difficult for even these terrific people to come up with an agreement here. I don't see how, certainly with an election year approaching, and given the debacle that has been, you know, on the Republican side, there's going to be any give on tax reform. And even under optimal circumstances, that's a hugely difficult problem. There's no way we can solve that, you know, between now and December 13. And absent that, the Democrats, the president, are not going to give on entitlement reform. And those are the two components you need to get a deal. So, you know, I think there are going to be a lot of meetings. Those meetings began today. I know that there was a breakfast meeting among the chairman and the ranking members of those two committees. So the process has begun, but I find it hard to believe that anything's going to happen between now and December 13.
Stephen?
I agree. I think we're going to be kicking the can again down on December 13th. And because we're going to be moving into an election year, I don't know what we can do.
Clark, let me come back to you then switch topics just to talk a little bit about the president and what you think his role is, and what does this do for the rest of his term as he emerges from this shutdown deal this week?
Right. Well, you know, conventional wisdom holds that the first year of a reelected president's second term is the year to get something done, because the next year, of course, is a midterm election year, and then the final 2 years are lame duck years as attention turns to the new presidential candidates. And so this really should have been, if there was to be any, a year of achievement for the president. But really, the whole of the year has been consumed by this big budget fight. And, you know, conspicuously in the president's remarks today, he tried to pivot to an agenda for the rest of the year, what remains of the year, and for the rest of the term. Talked about the need for immigration reform and talked about a farm bill. It was interesting to me he didn't mention cyber security as well, which has been a priority to date and I would argue should continue to be. But the likelihood of movement on immigration reform, he did not mention tax reform either, although, again, that would be ideally part of this package. There had been some efforts underway already with regard to that issue. The likelihood that any of these big issues are going to get done in the next years of his term is very, very low. And so I think you're going to likely see a string of executive orders, the president, you know, using the bully pulpit to try to shape the debate for years subsequent to his presidency. But, you know, this has been a lost year for the country. It's been a lost year for the president, I would argue.
Stephen, let me give you the same question, but a little bit different format.
Sure.
The president spent a lot of time criticizing Republicans in very pointed terms during the shutdown. What does that do for the political capital? He announces he wants to, you know, shift to immigration reform, shift to greenhouse gases, et cetera. How does that work for him if you're the Republican leadership now going forward?
I don't think it's going to help. The consistent complaint of the Republicans was that there was no give and take with the president moving into this crisis. Now, part of that was because the point, at least with respect to the government shutdown, was Obamacare. And if the Republicans had just left it alone, the story would have been the fiasco of the exchanges as they roll out 3 years after they were supposed to be It's 3 years after they were authorized, but instead it was the Republicans insisted on that. The president, however, on trying to tie in bigger picture issues with the debt ceiling and other, and in terms of trying to come up with a comprehensive plan, they've been talking about that for a while, and it got nowhere. And I just don't see how there's going to be anything significant accomplished once we get into 2014.
Clark, let me go back overseas. You talked about your trips abroad that you have coming in the next few weeks. Obviously, getting this close to the debt ceiling did a lot to hurt us. You mentioned what the Chinese have said, but talk to us about the decline in international credibility that seems like an obvious byproduct of what's going on in Washington and the dysfunction.
Right. Well, you know, we've got a confluence of matters. Stephen mentioned this in passing. You know, the story before the budget crisis was this very clumsy, and that's the nicest word I can think of, and again, I'm generally supportive of the president, run up to the decision on Syria. Now, we were headed toward a military strike to punish the Syrians for their use of chemical weapons and to degrade their ability to engage in chemical weapons attacks going forward. And then at the 11th hour, the president decided to consult Congress about it, and we were all gearing up for a vote, and it was pretty clear that he wasn't going to get a vote. And then Secretary Kerry made an offhand remark about a diplomatic solution, which the Russians seized upon, and now we are where we are. It looks as though we're moving toward a diplomatic resolution of this, but the point is, you know, the world was worried about that. Our Arab allies, Israel, were very concerned about whether we were seeing a failure of American leadership on a major international question. And now you couple that just a few weeks later with this budget crisis that, again, as I said, suggests that the United States is in the status of Italy now in terms of its political dysfunction. And it really does cause not just our enemies to see whether they can take advantage of us, but also our friends to shake their heads and wonder whether the United States can be counted on. So, you know, the president said today something I think that's true, and that is, you know, there really are no winners in this. The American people are losers. The United States is a loser because of the perception that the world has of us now of a country that's dysfunctional and hyperpartisan. And so I really hope that cooler heads prevail on both sides of the aisle and that we can come up somehow with a way to resolve this mess once and for all, and that we can do what we used to do, and that was to come together across partisan lines, at least with regard to national security matters.
Stephen, I got about 2 minutes. Tell me your thoughts about what the Tea Party does going forward and how Republicans in Congress treat them going forward.
I think the Tea Party is going to have a very tough future. The what Mike Johanns called the cul-de-sac strategy of backing themselves into a corner with Obamacare, I think has been very, very damaging and ironic given how the story would have been that people were furious about how it was implemented if they had just left the thing alone. There's an interesting story today in the Journal talking about how the Chamber of Commerce is going to be rethinking its approach to the party, and that one can begin to envision primary challenges to Tea Party members. And this is, you know, they have benefited from the fervor of their supporters, but if there is it'll be interesting to see if there's a significantly backed, more business-oriented approach rather than the but well-funded. If people like the Chamber of Commerce and other groups, and I would expect Crossroads to be involved in this too, Rove's column today was extremely critical of how they handled, the Tea Party handled this. I think they have a very limited shelf life as the decisive force in the party.
Excellent. Well, gentlemen, that's going to do it there. Clark Irvin, Stephen Gavin from Patton Boggs joining us to talk about the debt shutdown. We're going to be back after this commercial break to talk a little bit more about some policy issues here in Washington, D.C. here on Capital Thinking.
Thanks, Kevin.
Find out which guests are being featured this week. Read our network press releases and read the blog posts from your favorite hosts. Go to iRadioBlog.com today, powered by the Voice America Talk Radio Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Markaba.
From Denver to
Hello.
Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes
Niko.
Business transactions
Gracias.
The world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Stay up to date on the latest news out of Washington affecting your business. Check out Patton Boggs' new Capital Thinking blog at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. Let one of the world's best legal and political intelligence networks keep you in the loop on the policy developments that matter to you most. Access the network today at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. That's capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back, everyone. We're going to switch gears and talk a little bit about what's going on in Supreme Court and in the legal world regarding patent enforcement, some changes in patent law there. Joining us, Richard Operl, a partner at Patton Boggs, experienced litigator with a couple decades of trial experience and appellate work. He spends a lot of his time on intellectual property issues, and he's going to talk to us about these patent issues before the Supreme Court. Richard, welcome back to the show, and maybe tee us up and explain to folks what's going on just generally in the world of patents and what the fights are before we get into the specifics of these two Supreme Court cases.
Sure, Kevin. Thanks. You know, there's been a lot of discussion in Washington and around the country in the last several months about what's called non-practicing entities. Some people call patent trolls. And there's a variety of definitions, but essentially they are entities that buy either one or two patents or hundreds of patents or literally thousands of patents. And their business model is to either go out and license those patents to companies or, if not, to potentially sue them for patent infringement. And there's different kinds of non-practicing entities or NPEs. There are some that are legitimate, you know, companies that have research facilities and do research, but they also buy patent portfolios, which frankly is good for inventors because it enables them to monetize their asset. It's good for the technology industry because you do want patents to be available to people and to use them in their businesses. And there's a lot of non-practicing entities that follow that model. Unfortunately, there's a lot of non-practicing entities which really do fall into the patent troll category that have, you know, a couple of patents that they've bought from somebody, and they tend to be very broad. They also tend to be probably invalid patents. A lot of them relate to software and to business methods.
And what they do is send out huge numbers of letters to companies threatening to sue them. And if they, you know, they will give a deadline, say, we don't hear from you by 10 days, we're going to file suit. And then a lot of them do file suits, literally hundreds and hundreds of lawsuits. And some of the entities that they're suing, you know, range from mom-and-pop small businesses to medium-sized companies to Fortune 500 companies. And the problem in a lot of those cases is that you have you're probably facing an invalid patent, but it would cost you more in legal fees to litigate the case and fight the troll, whereas the troll will typically settle for a very, very small amount, well within the cost of litigation. So the patents never get tested in the courts as to whether or not they're valid. And it really can be and has been a problem. There have been a number of investigations by state attorney generals of those kinds of patent holding companies, and there's been a real cry for changes to the law regarding non-practicing entities over the last year. The White House came out with in June of this year with a report criticizing non-practicing entities and said we need to do something about it. You mentioned a couple of Supreme Court cases, and this is one area where it's potentially broader than just non-practicing entities, but I think it would certainly apply to them.
Yeah, Richard, is the Supreme Court giving people some ways to sort of push back against the trolls, for lack of a better word?
Well, what they have done is the court has agreed to hear two separate cases, both patent infringement cases, and they're about how attorney's fees get awarded to prevailing parties in patent cases. If the court rules a certain way, it could mean that more fee awards are made and would deter the filing of frivolous litigation against an accused patent infringer. You know, in the United States, we have something called the American rule, which each party to a lawsuit, you know, typically pays its own attorney's fees and expenses. There are some exceptions to that. If you bring a frivolous lawsuit and it's not in good faith and there's no basis for it in fact or law, you can get hit with sanctions, sometimes attorney's fees, but it's rare. The U.S. patent statute also allows a court to award attorney's fees to the winning party in an exceptional case. Exceptional truly means it. It's a very rigid standard that the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, which hears patent cases, all patent appeals, has set down. And you, if you were to go to court and fight a troll and win and have the patent declared invalid or not infringed, you then have to ask the judge to declare the case exceptional and award your fees. And then if he does that, he or she can then determine how much in fees to be supported. And there's a variety of things that make a case exceptional. If you've committed fraud on the patent office in getting your patent, that can render it exceptional. If you engage in misconduct during litigation, you don't follow your obligation for discovery or something, that can mean it's exceptional. Or it's a frivolous claim. But for the frivolous claim part, right now the Federal Circuit says that you've got to prove by clear evidence that the litigation filed by the plaintiff was objectively baseless and in subjective bad faith. And because of that high standard, you know, most cases are found not to be exceptional and no fees were awarded. Well, there were a couple of district court decisions in infringement cases recently. In one, a company that made
exercise machines got sued by a non-practicing entity, and the district court granted the defendants summary judgment motion, said that the products didn't infringe the patent. Well, the defendant then went to the court and said, Judge, please declare this an exceptional case. And the judge applied the existing standard and said, no, it's not exceptional. The defendant in that case said, Judge, you shouldn't apply that higher standard. You should apply something that's lower, that would make it easier for us to prove that this case was frivolous. They didn't win that argument in the district court, and they appealed it to the Federal Circuit, and the Federal Circuit rejected it, essentially saying, in kind of a back-of-the-hand way, we have no reason to revisit the settled standard. So they then asked the Supreme Court to hear the case, which just agreed to take it. And this, you know, there's reason to believe that the Supreme Court could reverse that. I mean, in recent years, the Supreme Court has reviewed a number of rulings from the Federal Circuit and have changed the standard. I don't think that the court is particularly happy with some of the things that the Federal Circuit does. So if in that case, the issue will be whether or not the test for being an exceptional case is loosened. And if it is, you'll find that there are more cases that are found to be exceptional.
Interesting. So talk a little more about what the two potential standards are that the court can use in reviewing these cases.
Yeah, they're the language of them, sounds on the surface sounds the same, but they're actually very different. Right now, you've got to show that it's objectively baseless, that there's no reasonable person would even consider this lawsuit to have merit. What the defendant in that case would like the standard to be is something called objectively unreasonable, which is it's easier to meet a reasonableness standard. And so while it's a subtle difference in language, it's really a quite different standard. And just in the other case, right now the Federal Circuit, when it reviews a district court decision on an award of attorney's fees and someone appeals it to the Federal Circuit, the Federal Circuit doesn't give the district court's decision any deference. It looks at the issue as if it was coming to court for the first time. In the second case, the Supreme Court has agreed to hear whether or not it should give deference. The Federal Circuit should defer to the district court's ruling except in some unusual circumstances. And again, that, to the extent that you have a loosened standard and you give greater deference to district court decisions, it really will make it easier for fees to be awarded. And it could significantly affect patent litigation in the United States. I mean, particularly where you have a non-practicing entity that doesn't have a lot of assets, that's of the troll variety, that they're suing hundreds or thousands of people for thousands of dollars, anywhere between I've seen cases where they've said we'll settle for $500 to $10,000-$20,000, which is well within the cost of living, well within the cost of litigation. And when you're an MPE, you want to go in, file a suit and get a quick settlement. That's what your business model is. Knowing that a defendant could obtain attorney's fees would encourage those accused infringers to fight the allegations in court rather than settling, having really a pretty good idea that they will recover their fees. And the hope would be that you would reduce the number of those patent troll cases from being filed. Again, the higher end of the non-practicing entity where they have research facilities and their real businesses, they do their homework and
and really don't bring the kind of frivolous cases that you see on the lower end. So there's, you know, I don't think that they would be affected very much by these changes, but certainly I think we could see a significant reduction in the number of patent cases being filed.
Very good. Richard, we're going to wrap it up there. Why don't you give people your email address if they have questions?
Sure. It's ropairil@patentbogs.com. ROPARIL.
Great. Well, we're going to be back in just a minute to talk about implementation of the Affordable Care Act here on Capital Thinking.
Your favorite Voice America Talk Radio Network shows and hosts are in your car, outdoors, and wherever you need them to be.
Listen anywhere.
Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, all this focus on the government shutdown and the debt ceiling extension has obscured all the attention that could have been paid to the rollout of the Affordable Care Act. Joining us is Karen Teal from our Patton Boggs healthcare policy team. Now, Karen, you were on 2 weeks ago, right before the new exchanges launched on October 1st, and I think it's fair to say that some of the negative pejorative adjectives thrown around at the debt ceiling fight here by the Republicans could also be thrown at the rollout of the Affordable Care Act exchanges. Tell us a little bit about what the experience has been after 2 weeks.
Well, of course, there's been a lot of press about this. In fact, there's a front page story today in Politico about the problems with the exchanges. Some people are calling them glitches. Some people are calling them real problems. You know, this is a complicated set of enrollment processes, and it's a big programmatic change. Anytime anybody is launching a new product or has a new computer system, things will go wrong. It's just, I think that this has been so publicly going wrong and so much consumer frustration. The state exchanges appear, for the most part, to be doing a little bit better than the federal exchange. And keep in mind, there are 15 of those state exchanges. that include the District of Columbia, and then the federal exchange has the balance of the states that chose to defer to the federal exchange. You have things that are happening, like people couldn't get on. I even tried to get on about a week ago, and there was a delay in getting on. People can get on and not get off. That actually has had a double effect. Number one, there are glitches. The administration has acknowledged that. They are having their contractors, they took the system down the first weekend. They continue to work on it. But also, and something the Washington Post reported yesterday, all of the issues that have surfaced in the press about the problems have caused a real dropout, often people going to the federal exchange. And apparently, between October 1 and the first 2 weeks almost of the exchange, there was an 88% drop-off in people even trying to get on the exchange. So that's a problem.
Yeah, let me ask you about that. I mean, my sense is that young people in particular are not the kind of folks who show patience and are going to go back time and again to a website that was inoperational the first few times they tried it. Now, the goal of the administration was to have 7 million people that were uninsured get enrolled in this six-month open enrollment period. I read stories like Delaware saying they had one person register through their exchange so far, and they had a ceremony for that person. I'm thinking, how possible is it that at the end of March we're actually going to come anywhere close to these numbers?
Well, that $7 million figure was a Congressional Budget Office figure that the administration also bought into. And what's so important about that figure, Kevin, as you point out, about 40% of that 7 million were the healthy young adults. About 2.7 million of those were the young adults that you absolutely need to come into the exchanges and get insured because they're healthy and they spread the risk over to the insurance plans of sicker people with more chronic conditions who are very likely to be early signer uppers also. There are very ambitious, actually the slow start goals, there's a memo from HHS, the slow start goals were to have 500,000 people enrolled by the end of October and 3.3 million people enrolled by the end of December. Obviously that's going to be impacted by some of these changes. The other thing is, when you go into the exchange, based on your income level, you'll either be eligible to get a subsidy on the exchange or you'll qualify for traditional Medicaid or Medicaid expansions. The government has just announced that the federal exchanges won't be able to transfer Medicaid applications to the states until November 1st. And so that will be another watershed moment for the functionality of the exchanges. If all of those Medicaid applications can't get to the states, that will be a real problem. The other thing is, people, in order to have your insurance be affected by January 1st, 2014, and to have those subsidy payments paid out to the insurers on your behalf to get some reductions in your cost sharing, you really need to be enrolled by December 15th because it takes some time to process it, and the coverage always is going to start on the first of the month. So to the extent that these glitches aren't resolved or there aren't workarounds for them, that can interfere with people's ability to have insurance up and running on the first of the year.
You mentioned Medicaid, and obviously a big part of the Affordable Care Act had to do with expansion of Medicaid, getting low-income uninsured covered. But after the Supreme Court decision, the states got to decide for themselves whether or not to expand. A lot of states chose not to, and I'm wondering, is there any give among some of those states to reconsider?
Yes, there is, and we talked a little bit about this last time, too. CMS indicated that it was willing to fund some demonstrations that would take alternative approaches, and the state of Arkansas was the first state to successfully get approval for CMS approval for a three-year Medicaid waiver. They're going to take the amount that they would have gotten, the federal dollars they would have gotten for the Medicaid expansions, and instead use that for people who qualify, low-income people under 138% of the federal poverty line, to purchase insurance on the exchanges. So it's kind of a public-private partnership model. And that has been approved. We said a couple weeks ago other states are going to be looking at that. Pennsylvania has already filed a similar waiver to the federal government to do that type of it's called premium assistance or alternative premium assistance programs. New Hampshire is also discussing that. So that's something to watch. What's a problem here is the states that did not choose to expand Medicaid if you make 100% of the federal poverty level, you're going to still be able to go on the exchanges and get a pretty hefty subsidy and get health insurance. The poorest of the poor, those who make uninsured adults making under 100% of the federal poverty line, under about little under $12,000 a year, in a state that didn't expand Medicaid, they have no option. So they will continue to be uninsured.
Let me ask you real quick, sort of last question here. There's some healthcare related provisions in the deal that was struck last night. Talk to us a little bit about what's in there.
Yeah, basically the only provision that affects the Affordable Care Act were some increased income verification procedures. Income verification was in the Affordable Care Act. It was in the rules that were issued by Department of Health and Human Services, but not as rigorous as particularly House Republicans wanted to see. And there's been a big push in recent weeks to try to get that much more rigorous. So right now, the Secretary has the responsibility by the first date of the exchanges to issue a report to Congress on what procedures have been put in place to verify income prior to any premium assistance being provided, the subsidies, or any cost-sharing provisions put in place for individual applicants. And then in July, there'll be a report by the Office of the Inspector General at HHS on whether these provisions have worked and whether there's actually income fraud being committed by any of the applicants.
Very good. Well, Karen, just enough time for you to give us your email address for people who want to follow up.
Email address is kthiel@pattenbogs.com.
Great. That'll do it for this week's Capital Thinking. Everyone have a great weekend. We'll see you next week for more.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.